Hello, and welcome to episode 19 of what is now Curiosityness, the podcast. This episode was super fun. I'm so glad she decided, or she was willing to come on to talk with me. This is Jill Heinerth. I hope I pronounced that right. Sorry, Jill. Of Into the Planet. That's her website, intotheplanet.com. And she is a cave diver. So she does all this super crazy stuff. She has such a cool story. So we talk about all that. But then we talk a lot about her cave diving stuff and everything she does with that and kind of the equipment she uses, like the dangers of all that stuff. She was the first person to dive into a iceberg. So we talk about that. Super cool. Talk about the technology, like the 3D mapping stuff that she does when she goes down there, and what maybe like the future of AR and like tourism augmented reality stuff might be. So this was just a super cool and very interesting episode that I hope you will enjoy. So here we go, on to the podcast. Here is Jill. Okay, well, we're going.
Okay.
It happened. All right. Hello, Jill. Thanks for being on the show.
Hey, nice to be with you.
This is awesome. Super excited. So you're up in Canada right now. I'm in LA. Yeah. Our temperatures are a little different, but that's all right. So I guess let's just start by like, how would you, if someone asks you, you know, what you do, I guess, what would you say to them? How would you describe it?
Well, my business card says I'm an explorer. So that's the simplest of descriptions. But I have kind of a hybrid career of underwater filmmaking and photography and consulting on underwater life support equipment, a little bit of teaching, public speaking. So all kinds of stuff, everything that can keep me underwater.
Okay. So you want to be underwater. That's the goal. Interesting. Okay. So I don't know. I just want to know like how this all started. Like your story is just so interesting and what you do. So can we just kind of start like how did this germinate in your mind and get going?
You know, ever since I was a little kid, I wanted to be an explorer. I mean, I grew up watching Jacques Cousteau on TV and watching Apollo missions where, you know, guys were landing on the moon and driving around on little rovers, and we would gather in the school library, the entire school, and watch a little teeny black and white television that wasn't much bigger than my computer is today, and watch these incredibly, you know, historic events. And I thought, God, I want to be an explorer. Like, I think maybe I want to be an astronaut. And then people would pull me aside and say, well, you know, we don't have a space program in Canada. And well, women aren't astronauts. So
it's messed up.
Yeah, but I still, you know, the seed was planted, and I wanted to find a way to do things that nobody had ever done before. So, you know, so that's kind of the childhood seed that was planted. When it came time to figure out, you know, what I wanted to do with my life and go to university, I was having a lot of trouble because I kind of wanted to do everything. You know, I was interested in science, but not one specific facet of science. I was interested in engineering and technology. So I took a Bachelor of Fine Arts.
Okay.
I'm actually an artist. So I have a degree in visual communications and design. And that's proved really great for me. I had an ad agency in Toronto when I came out of school, and that was very successful. But I quickly learned that it was like too much time indoors and not enough time outdoors doing what I love. So I sold that, moved to the Cayman Islands, and tried to find a way to mesh the underwater world and my creative life.
Wow. And so how did that mesh? How did that happen?
Well, I mean, the first thing I did was just get rid of my stuff, which, you know, some people think that's hard, and it is hard when you're thinking about it. It's like, oh man, I have a really nice car and I have a really comfortable house. And, but I just sold everything, you know, big giant curb alert, and moved to the Cayman Islands with a suitcase full of dive gear and an underwater camera, and thought, okay, with the stuff gone, I can just focus on shooting and getting better at it and figuring out a way forward as to, you know, how I could make a living in the underwater world.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, that, I mean, good for you to make that kind of move. That's crazy.
Yeah, it seemed like family is insane. I made the most money of my life when I was like 21 and had my advertising business. But I'm way happier with the time and the freedom and doing what I really love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you had your advertising business, and then, I mean, what kind of stuff were you doing with that? Were you building like marketing campaigns and stuff for businesses, or were you more doing like photo shoots, or what was the whole deal?
No, I mean, we specialized in something called corporate identity programs. So like a company that needs a logo and a branding and a complete plan for their visual image, we would do that. But like I had clients like Nike Canada, Canon Canada, Labatt's Breweries, what is now the Toronto International Film Festival. Great clients, IBM. And so the business was successful, but maybe it was too successful because I wasn't having enough time to do the fun stuff that I love to do outside.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that. Cool. So you made the move, you sold the company and moved down to the Cayman Islands. And then, so, I mean, what did you do down there? Like, what was kind of your daily life down there?
I worked at a little place called the Cayman Diving Lodge. So I had, my lodging and transportation, everything's covered because I was living on site there. And so suddenly I had no bills, right? So ultimate freedom. But right. I was teaching diving and taking people out on guided dives and doing underwater photography and the marketing for this resort. And it was a little 12-room, beautiful little resort on the sort of unpopulated side of the island with great diving opportunities. And I did that for almost 3 years. Yeah.
Wow, perfect. Yeah. So did you get to do diving up in Canada before?
Yeah, yeah. I learned to dive in Canada in the Great Lakes in a place called Tobermory, which is an underwater national marine preserve where we have hundreds of shipwrecks. So really cool diving. Whoa. Yeah, yeah. It's beautiful. It's cold, but it's beautiful. And so I was a diving instructor back in Canada, teaching nights and weekends. And that's how I knew that for me, that was a happier job than my advertising work. Yeah.
Okay, I see. So you were already sort of doing it. So that's how you knew that it was really what you wanted to do. Wow. So what kind of so there's just a bunch of shipwrecks down there? Why is that?
Well, the Great Lakes, there's over 6,000 shipwrecks just because it's really hazardous navigation and the lakes are big, but when a lake storm blows up, it's almost worse than being out in big waves in the ocean because the lake waves are closer together and take down, these ships. Like a lot of them are in the range of like 1 to 250 years old, like wooden sailing ships and things. Yeah. Really cool.
Yeah, that's really cool to see.
And they're totally, preserved because they don't degrade the same way they would if they were in the ocean.
Wow, that's cool. So, and this is just like you would take tours off, tours of people out to see this stuff. Is that what you were doing?
And teaching. I was teaching new divers, taking them on their first experiences in the open water. Yeah.
That's cool. So can I still go there today and find that stuff?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a great place to dive.
Okay. And that's just kind of in the Great Lakes there and stuff. I can find that.
It's called Tobermory. And I mean, there's so many great areas in the Great Lakes to dive, including Canada's best secret is the St. Lawrence Seaway because the wrecks there are also old wooden shipwrecks. And the water's really fast there, but in the summertime it's warm. So we get, up to 78 degree water in the summertime in the St. Lawrence. And most people don't realize you can get that in Canada at all.
Yeah, really? What is that called again?
The St. Lawrence Seaway. That's what connects the Great Lakes to the Atlantic Ocean. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. St. Lawrence Seaway. Man, I'm going to check that out. That is cool. I haven't really done any diving, just kind of like, snorkeling kind of stuff just on the surface in Florida and different things like that. But it's cool. I could see how it would get like addicting.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. So what happened after the, after your kind of 3 years at that resort in the Cayman Islands.
Yeah. I mean, I was getting ready for a change, and I had gotten into cave diving, for me, through those, and I volunteered for an expedition, with a guy, Dr. Bill Stone. And it was with the United States Deep Caving Team, and we were going down to central Mexico, to this mountainous area near Huautla, where we were exploring an area that could hold the world's deepest vertical cave. And so I volunteered for the project thinking, okay, I'm going to go along and support the expedition, you know, work in the base camp, you know, schlep water, whatever needed to be done. And one thing led to another. And by the end of the project, I was like diving on the end of the line in these exploratory caves. And then I was really hooked.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's cave diving like? I mean, most of the mm-hmm. world has never even done it or kind of yeah. like, I mean, I have an idea of what it is, but like, I don't even yeah. know for sure what cave diving is, honestly.
Yeah. So beneath your feet, basically, especially in areas of the earth that are covered with a lot of limestone. So Florida, the Bahamas, Mexico, you know, other places, you know, the Ural Mountains in Siberia. So all over the world, there are areas that are primarily limestone. Limestone is really easy to erode. So when the rain falls on the surface of the earth and it, you know, soaks into the ground and weaves its way in between grains of sand, it actually erodes passages as it does that over time. And when those passages are below the water table, you know, the water table being like, if you're on the beach and you stick your shovel into the sand, eventually you hit water,
right?
That's the water table. So inland, the water table is just a little bit deeper, but in those caves then that are beneath your feet, there's water just flowing through high velocity. Sometimes in really small spaces, too small for me to swim through. Sometimes in spaces like, you know, crawling under the chair of your kitchen table, you know. And sometimes in spaces that are like big enough to put an entire aircraft hangar inside of.
Wow.
So, yeah. So beneath your feet in these underwater, water-filled tunnels, I'm swimming in what I call the veins of Mother Earth. So I'm swimming inside the sustenance of the planet, this very same water that you might draw up out of the ground in a well for drinking water. Yeah.
Whoa, that is cool.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, some people say it's the world's most dangerous sport or activity
uh-huh.
because a lot of people have died diving in underwater caves. But for me, with the right equipment and training and practice, it's just been an incredible opportunity to go places no one's ever been before.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I guess what makes it so dangerous?
Well, as soon as you go into what we call an overhead environment, you're swimming inside a tunnel, basically. We might go like 2 miles inside the earth. So something goes wrong with your equipment, you've got to be able to deal with it yourself without help, with additional equipment you have with you, and figure out how to get home. But there's also environmental things that can go wrong, like it's easy to disturb the visibility and suddenly you can't see. And so we lay a thin nylon guideline through the cave so that if we ever had to, we could come out holding on to that guideline and just run it through our hands as we swim out. But there's, you know, other things that can go wrong too, either with your partner, your equipment, or the environment. And it takes, you know, steely nerves and experience and training to deal with it.
Yeah. Man, that is crazy stuff. So what is training look like for that? How do you train for that?
Well, a lot of people who do traditional scuba diving, we call that recreational scuba diving. They have a single tank on their back. They're inhaling a breath of air, exhaling bubbles into the environment. And anytime something scares the crap out of them, they can just swim straight to the surface, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't go too long. They don't go too deep. They certainly don't go into an overhead environment. So literally it takes years of additional training through levels, everything from like rescue diving procedures to what we call technical diving procedures, like going much deeper or farther into the earth making sometimes like very slow staged returns back to the surface so that your body can reacclimate to surface pressure, right, using sometimes exotic gases like helium mixes, sometimes using life support equipment that's more like what an astronaut uses for a spacewalk than what a scuba diver uses for a traditional recreational dive. So yeah, I've you know, had dives where I've had, you know, tons of tanks with me, you know, and sometimes it literally even 500 pounds of equipment that I'm dragging into the cave in order to do a long mission or a deep mission.
Oh my gosh. How long are generally, I guess it depends on where you're going and stuff, but how long or what's maybe the longest that you've done a cave diving?
My longest dive mission was about 22 hours long. Yeah.
Like underwater for 22 hours.
Actually, in this case, it was about 12 hours underwater and then a slow like return to the surface and with a period of time spent like locked into a steel chamber that was slowly releasing the pressure on my body.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wait, so what was the steel chamber? How does that work?
So something called a recompression chamber is used to, normally it's used to treat somebody who's got what we call decompression illness. But we used it in a different creative way. We knew because of the extreme depth of the dive that we were doing and the extreme length of exposure that we were going to have a long time to have to decompress our bodies. And we were going to get like too cold, perhaps hypothermic, finishing that underwater. But there's also so much risk underwater. If something goes wrong during decompression, you drown, you know. But what we managed to do was send down this little, almost like a submarine capsule underwater that I could get into. And then we pressurize the space inside the capsule. So my body is held at extreme pressure. Uh-huh. And then slowly over the course of another, you know, 10 or more hours, the pressure is very slowly released so that my body can reacclimatize to the surface.
Okay, I see.
Yeah. It's like take a pop bottle, right? A soda pop bottle. Uh-huh. And if you just very slowly take the cap off a bottle, it might just go, you know, and that's it.
Yeah.
But if you shake up the pop bottle and then take the lid off fast, little bubbles that are pressed into solution inside the pop bottle suddenly, like, you know, fizz and blow out of the bottle.
Right.
Your body's the same. When you're on deep, longer exposures underwater, you have to very slowly release that pressure, or you could have a life-threatening injury with decompression illness.
Okay, I see.
Yeah.
So was it, in this case, was it where you sort of like slowly swam down and deeper with more pressure, and then this kind of submarine was down kind of at your lowest elevation there waiting for you?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, I went into the cave at a depth of about 300 feet deep, which is much beyond the recreational limits. And I'm breathing a weird mixture of oxygen, helium, and nitrogen. And I go off for, you know, 5 hours at 300 feet deep. And then all that nitrogen and helium is getting stored into my tissues because my body doesn't metabolize that. It metabolizes the oxygen. But the helium and the nitrogen are kind of useless. So it's just stuffed away there in micro bubbles. So then I come out of the cave and I start to have to very slowly work my way up to let that pressure be naturally exhaled through just respiration. And then by the time I got to about 130 feet deep, they could get this capsule to me in the entrance of the cave. Uh-huh. And at that point, I could climb into it, strip off all my gear, and get sealed in. Yeah.
Wow. That's cool. That's so crazy.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. And that just the fact that you're able to figure that out and know that you can do it and kind of go to these crazy limitations, that's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, that was true exploration, not just in the swimming into the cave. Like, and we were actually making the world's very first three-dimensional map of a cave system, dry or wet. on that project, but it was also, you know, exploration in the terms of the procedures and things that we figured out, like from the mapping device to the decompression to all the gear that was needed for it. So there was a lot of engineering and exploration required.
Yeah, totally. So was that, did you just kind of go solo down there by yourself, or were there other people?
So I had a, each time I had a partner with me, so that we'd do a two-man team, but it took, over the course of well, first of all, it took 2 years to develop all the technology, the procedures and practice. Oh, but then when we had the field work, we were in the field for 3 months and we had a total of 150 volunteers. We were all volunteers.
Wow.
And yeah, yeah. So people would come and go for a day, a week or whatever. And when, you know, I'd be off in the cave doing the exploration, there'd be other people, you know, getting this pressurized capsule ready, you know, getting all the download materials ready to deal with the data that we would bring back. We'd have safety divers that would meet us and help us get into this capsule. So it took a lot of people doing a lot of different things, you know, cooking for us.
Yeah, right. It's true.
You know, there were people with no diving background whatsoever that were incredible help as volunteers on the project. Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy stuff you wouldn't even think of, just like the normal, you know, yeah. Food. Yeah.
Yeah. Who's going to vacuum? We've been here for 3 months. Who's going to vacuum the mission control?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool. So what, you did like a 3D mapping of the cave?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what was the, why do that? Like what was the point?
Up until that point in history, nobody had ever done an accurate, you know, and especially an accurate three-dimensional map of any cave system, dry or wet. And these cave systems are carrying your drinking water. So not only is it useful to, you know, see what the inside of the planet looks like, but know exactly where it is. So we developed some other technology that would allow us to precisely locate where these tunnels were in relation to the surface of the Earth. So then all of a sudden, hydrologists would know, where's the drinking water? You know, is it safe to put a gasoline tank here under a gas station? Or if it leaks, is it going to completely contaminate all the drinking water resources for, you know, Tallahassee, Florida?
Yeah.
And then to be able to model these spaces and understand, you know, how much water is coming out and where is it coming from, you know, ultimately, if there's a chemical spill in another part of the state, is that going to affect this drinking water? How many days is that going to take before it happens? So there's a lot of really interesting, you know, science that comes out of all of that work. Now, the data was also some of the very first accurate 3D modeling data. So not just engineers and hydrologists were interested in it. The mathematicians and gamers use that as some of the really early stuff to, you know, model, you know, virtual environments that things happened in. And even today, you know, the gaming industry and then some of the engineers that I work with in 3D modeling work really closely together.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. So, I mean, is this, when was this? How long ago was this?
20 years ago. Yeah,
okay,
that was 20
so
years ago.
Crazy. Yeah. So has this become like, is it more of a standard practice now? Is this happening more?
No, I mean, it's still really edgy, expensive technology, all funded by, you know, private enterprise, basically. That mapping device has continued to be supported through various entities, but its biggest mission ahead is that NASA is now supporting it. And it's an artificially intelligent robotic mapper. It doesn't need me anymore. It can be put into, yeah, it can be put into an underwater space and it can go fetch the map on its own. It can make thinking decisions to turn a corner, to turn around, to come back, conserve its fuel,
whoa,
sample something that might be life, you know. And that's going to go to Jupiter's moon Europa for exploration under the frozen surface in the oceans of Europa.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's cool. And this is the exact kind of same device that you were using.
Well, it's like version 4, basically. It's been engineered and shrunk down and now it's robotic and intelligent. And
yeah.
inside of a power plant or a dam or some deep ocean vent. It'll be able to do anything and more than what I could do.
Man, yeah, that's so cool how stuff kind of evolves like that.
Yeah, it's incredible. And that's been, you know, my colleague, Bill Stone, that invited me on that first project. It's been his baby and his life's work since then.
Yeah, that's awesome. So is that kind of maybe like the future of stuff where we have, you know, we kind of had like our 2D maps, and then we've been sort of mapping like three-dimensionally on top stuff, like on top of the Earth. But then now are we going to start going down?
Oh, absolutely. We still know more about space than we do about the inside of our planet. So there's a lot of places and spaces to explore inside the planet, but also unique biology, archaeology, you know, the remains of paleo animals, the remains of ancient civilizations. And we're applying really interesting new engineering technologies to documenting that stuff too. Similar sort of scanning and mapping technologies that allow us to now scan artifacts inside of caves in virtual reality and augmented reality, and then create holographic replicas of things that we find underwater in these amazing caves.
Whoa, that's cool. So it could almost like me as just a general like user, I could kind of use virtual reality or something to explore these caves and stuff.
Yeah, that's where we're going now. So another colleague of mine has developed some of the highest resolution scanning capability and photogrammetry and LiDAR scanning that allows him to, you know, replicate an environment and objects within it. And using things like a Microsoft HoloLens, you can either, you know, use these as augmented reality assets. Like I could project a skull in the space in between you and I, and we could rotate it, look at it, and zoom in on things. And it would look like it was just suspended between us within our environment.
Right.
But we can also create entire environments. Like my colleague, Corey Jaskolski, just scanned all of Petra, Jordan, the archaeology site, so that people will be able to move through that at a ridiculous level of detail that you've never seen before.
Wow. That is super, super cool. That's so fun.
Yeah.
So what was the site that he just did in Jordan, you said?
Petra, Jordan, and he's scanning Machu Picchu right now. So all of these and these iconic environments he's scanning for. You know, we don't even know how he's going to use them yet. He's going to have these assets. They could be used by gamers. They might be used as virtual travel, you know, opportunities, education. Sky's the limit.
Yeah, man, that's so cool. Is there like an opportunity, or like, I'm sure someone's working on this, where you could, like kind of scan an area or something or some sort of ruins, and then like kind of digitally recreate what we think the original like structure
absolutely
like.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So cool.
I mean, and imagine, you know, in the future of even tourism, you might be walking down the street wearing, you know, a Microsoft HoloLens or Google Glasses or something like that, and the tour guide's saying, oh, how would you like to see what the facade of this building looked like 200 years ago? You know, I'll send that data to you right now. And suddenly the city that's before you is transformed to another era. Or here's what planners want to do with this city in the future. I'll just, you know, morph it in front of you and project other assets like in your path that you can interact with.
Yes. Oh yeah. My gosh, that's so cool. So that would just be like, that would just augment the reality. That'd be AR, right?
Yeah, which is so much better than VR because, I mean, I don't know about you, but I put on a VR headset and I got to hold on to something, you know, every once in a while you feel sick and you certainly feel exhausted from the VR experience. But AR is like you have your natural world around you and then assets are added to it. Like, so an asset could be an object, but it might also be, you know, a virtual or an augmented tour guide that, you know, walks with you through an environment. And yeah.
That's so cool.
Think about young people today and the kind of jobs that they're going to be doing with these sorts of technologies, these, you know, robotic AR, you know, digital mapping, scanning. There's so much. We don't even have titles for the kinds of jobs jobs that they'll have.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's all being created. Okay. Man, imagine like how cool it would, like how fun it would be to be in school and to have this kind of stuff when you're learning about, you know, all this history and different things like that and visit them. That must, mm-hmm. that would be so great. It'd be so cool.
I mean, well, think about it in, you know, the context of my life as a child, you know, we had textbooks and then the textbooks are, you know, immediately out of date. Right. I mean, yep. I think about like the map that was on the wall in my school as a child. I was at this museum yesterday and I was looking at a map on the wall from my childhood era. And I'm like, geez, those countries don't exist anymore. Those borders don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, now, like in my lifetime, we've got the internet. So we've got the world's knowledge now available to us at our fingertips, but still it's not the same kind of thing as what's going to be available in a very short few years with, you know, augmented reality technologies and beyond. You will have everything current at your fingertips. Like mm-hmm. you could be attending a conference in, you know, Istanbul in your living room, you know, yeah. interacting with the people at that conference in a meaningful way that's better than, you know, the Skype that we're doing now.
Like, mm-hmm.
Skype would have been unimaginable to me as a child, you know?
Yeah, right. And now yeah. it's just everyday life.
Yeah.
Man, stuff yeah. is so cool like this.
It is.
Yeah, like that's super exciting. I love that.
Yeah,
me too. It depends for every cave, I guess, you're doing, but when you're doing the cave divings, how do you access them?
So it depends. So there's a lot of different places around the world where I cave dive. Like North Florida is an extremely popular area to cave dive because there's hundreds of springs that are inland. Essentially, the water comes up out of a hole in the ground and serves as the source of a creek or a river. And so we dive into these holes in the ground. So it's like the beginning of the river from inside the planet. But there's other places where you go offshore in the ocean and dive off a boat and go down to the seafloor and you go into a hole in the seafloor that has a cave system attached to it. But I swim inside of lava tubes of volcanoes. I swim under the Sahara Desert. I swim inside icebergs. I swim inside all kinds of crazy environments.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Well, can we talk about one of those? What, like,
yeah.
I guess, what was it? Tell me about the Antarctica stuff.
Yeah. I was the very first person to go cave diving inside an iceberg back in the year 2000, the largest iceberg in recorded history calved away from the Ross Ice Shelf. And, you know, that seems like really important news today, but it was a very early sort of portent of global climate change. The iceberg was the size of Jamaica, and suddenly this broke away from the Ross Ice Shelf. And so my colleague and I proposed to National Geographic that we would go down there and we would climb it, dive around it, and we would be the first people to cave dive inside of an iceberg. And so we went down to New Zealand, took a 12-day crossing of the Southern Ocean, and then got there and went inside these unbelievable environments, incredibly dangerous, but beautiful. I mean, you can imagine an iceberg or an ice cube floating in your drink is constantly changing. It's melting, it's cracking, it's breaking apart.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so are icebergs.
Right.
Except we also have the addition of like strong ocean currents, not just lateral currents, but currents that are rushing downward and pulling you into the depths. And the doorway of a cave that you swim into, like calving and blocking your access. And it's crazy. Yeah.
Wow, that is gnarly stuff. So you, like, did you really, since you were the first to do it, did you kind of, I mean, I'm sure you had an idea, but you didn't really know exactly what was going to happen, what was going to be going on, right?
No, we didn't even know whether we would actually find caves in these icebergs. We just did a really good sales pitch to National Geographic. And it was good enough that they went, oh my God, there's caves inside of icebergs. And we went, hell yeah, there's caves. And, they, you know, gave us the check. We went down there and it was like 30 days. We were down there before we found something that really lived up to what we had pitched. Right?
All right. Yeah.
But we didn't know what we were going to find. And again, that's part of exploration. There's no handbook if nobody's done it before. So it's every day you've got to face risk and think about, you know, how you can safely do this, or if you should safely do something. Mm-hmm. And every day you learn something new about the environment and the risk and make a choice to go on or not.
Yeah, for real. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So I guess what was the goal of that? Just kind of like to do it, to get in there and check it out?
Yeah, I mean, it was pure exploration. We did have some scientists on board that had specific goals. Like we had a whale specialist with us, and he was chasing an elusive report of a unique species of killer whale, which we did manage to get a DNA sample from. So we did confirm that. Oh, wow. And we were doing some science for some jellyfish specialists. But the rest of it, the cave diving and everything else, was an opportunity for us to do some real exploration, but also to tell a story about global climate change. And back in 2000, like, it was even crazier than it is today. People are like, global climate change, what the hell? What's that? That's not real. And I was even told when I was writing the film that went with this project not to use that term. It was too incendiary, you know.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, oh wow, is right. I mean, that was just an early sign of things to come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Man.
So, are there any? Were you able to get any like photos or any kind of stuff like that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We had a National Geographic article, and we did a film called Ice Island, a documentary film
that shows
Ice Island. It's pretty hard to find now. It's out of print, but you'll at least find like some shorts on the internet, some pieces of really cool footage from it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I'm going to check that out, Ice Island. Okay.
Yeah. On my YouTube page, there's the trailer to the film.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. Yeah. What's your YouTube username so people can find it?
It's just my name. So YouTube/Jill Heinerth.
Okay, perfect. Cool.
Yeah.
I'll put a link to that and stuff too.
Yeah, it's in the show notes.
Wow. So what kind of like, you mentioned the equipment a little bit, like sometimes you've had, you know, 500 pounds of equipment and stuff. What generally are you using?
So when we have long distances to travel, either inside a cave or in difficult currents in the ocean, we use underwater scooters. So a little torpedo-like device that has a propeller on it that'll pull us through the water. So I might be driving one scooter and dragging along a second one in case it breaks down. The life support equipment we use is called a rebreather. So we inhale a breath from this device, and then the breath is captured, so you don't make any bubbles. So the breath is captured in a loop, and it goes through a carbon dioxide scrubber that pulls the carbon dioxide out of the mix. A little bit of oxygen is injected back into the loop, and then when the gas comes back around to you again, recirculated, it's back to the right life support levels for you.
And, oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So as you're diving deeper, you're constantly manipulating the levels of oxygen and helium and nitrogen, so it's just right. Mm-hmm. For a particular dive. And then it's also keeping track of everything that's going into your body so that you can deal with basically a mathematical algorithm to decompress properly afterwards.
Man, that's crazy. That's awesome that's all been figured out and it's down to a science like that.
Yeah, it's exactly the same equipment that an astronaut uses to make a spacewalk.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that same sort of backpack that they put on, and you can see that they've got, you know, a loop of hoses in front of their face, and it's basically the same thing we use.
Crazy. So it was called a rebreather, is that right?
A rebreather. Yeah.
So can that kind of last indefinitely, or is there a supply because you have to have the oxygen added to it?
Yeah. So there's still a gas supply of oxygen and then an inert gas mix that dilutes the oxygen because you can't breathe pure oxygen at depth. It's poisonous to you, or toxic to you. And so there is a gas supply, but there's also like a time limitation from the scrubbing device that removes the carbon dioxide. There's time limitations to the batteries and everything else. And then we also carry a whole bunch of regular tanks with gas in case rebreather breaks. Because if you're 2 miles back inside a cave and then your rebreather electronics, you know, craps out, there's a lot of things you might be able to do to get home on it, but you might have to switch to like just traditional open circuit scuba gas to get you home. Mm-hmm. And that's some of the other weight that we have to carry along, or all these extra tanks.
Yeah, just in case stuff almost, huh? Like emergency stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So are you carrying all this stuff like on a kind of a backpack situation, or are you pulling something?
A little bit of all of that. Yeah. So we wear like stuff on our back. We strap extra tanks on our sides. We drag an extra scooter behind us, trailing behind us. But we try to make ourselves as like streamlined and low profile as possible so that we don't get snagged or entangled, or so that we can really quickly access anything we need or remove it if we have to fit through a small space and put it back on the other side. So everything has to be immediately accessible and reachable by practice. And, you know, we rehearse these things over and over and over again, like, because you can't breathe water and you don't have a lot of time to figure out what's safe to breathe next. Yeah.
Yeah. Man, that is some gnarly stuff. So is there like a particular moment or memory that got like really scary or something for you that you can think of?
Oh yeah. I mean, I've had a few scares. Inside that iceberg in Antarctica, I was basically trapped with my team. So there were two people with me, and the current became so strong all of a sudden that we were unable to get out of the iceberg. And our 1 hour dive suddenly turned into a 3 hour dive of just fighting for our lives to get out. It was so strong. It was just sucking us inward every time we tried to kick our way forward. And I didn't know whether I had the physical strength in order to overcome that situation, but we all did.
Oh my gosh. And
I've been in other situations where in a very small cave on traditional open circuit scuba, where every single, you know, breath is, you know, a finite time that you can stay in that overhead environment. My diving partner got stuck with me further into the cave than my diving partner. So that diving partner's like plugging the cave basically. Yeah. And if I don't solve my diving partner's problem, then I'm not getting home either. So that was a scary one. We were in zero visibility. The line broke. My life support packed it in, and suddenly I'm having a serious like gas loss issue all at the same time, and my partner's panicking. So so that was a tough one. Yeah.
Gosh, that is scary. Yeah, like just oof, man. So do you go through like specific training to kind of like handle those situations and stay calm and handle it correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do lots of training to keep my skills proficient and practiced so that when something happens, I know exactly what to do quickly. But mentally, I also, you know, very carefully assess the risk and then rehearse things in my mind before I get in the water so that when something happens, there's zero emotions attached to it, because emotions can't help you in those kinds of situations. In fact, all the emotions do is make you breathe faster, make your heart rate go up, and shorten the time window that you have available to survive. So I've used that mental discipline both in cave diving, but in everything I do in life. Like something scares the crap out of me and my heart's starting to go fast and I'm breathing fast, so the first thing I do is take a deep breath and just say, whew, you know, emotions, you're no good to me now. Yeah. I got to think about that next pragmatic step that I can take towards success and survival, and slowly, continuously march towards that until it happens.
Nice. Yeah, it's easy to say, but probably tough to do, huh?
Well, after you've done it once, like after you've had a really big scare and then overcome, the next one's easier and the next one's easier after that. So even if there's nothing like huge that ever scares you in life, if there's something small that you're scared about, if you're scared about putting like a new boss's desk, or if you're scared to ride your mountain bike down the ski hill in winter or whatever, you know, you can say to yourself, all right, you know, emotions aren't going to serve me right now. So what's the next best step that I can make? And then if the fear is still not going away, then realize that that fear is really closely allied to excitement. Like everybody goes to theme parks and gets on roller coasters for fear and excitement, right?
Yeah.
So if you can turn the negatives of fear into excitement because you're standing on the edge of discovery and exploration, then do that. And that completely transforms the situation. And it helps you accept the outcome of whatever happens.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good way to turn that into like a positive.
Yeah.
I like that. Cool. So you mentioned that you had to kind of convince National Geographic to go on their thing. So I'm curious, like, how do these, the cave divings and all the stuff that you do, how does it normally like germinate? Is it somebody comes to you asking you to do this work for them, or is it kind of your ideas that you get going?
Sometimes it's a bit of both. So sometimes I get a call, you know, from National Geographic or Discovery Channel or whatever, you know, will you film this for us, this shipwreck, this cave, this whatever. Mm-hmm. But more often I'm coming up with my own ideas and story pitches to different organizations, or I just do something completely independently. Like, this is something I want to pursue, so I'm going to chase the narrative and create a product, whether it's a, you know, a book or a film or a speaking gig, and transform that into something that might turn into a paycheck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Perfect. So what kind of stuff is, what kind of stuff is important to you, like to you, that you're kind of looking to talk about and share?
Yeah. I mean, I do a lot of motivational speaking. So I go to corporations, but I also go to schools. And when I go to schools, I talk to kids about curiosity and about discovery and exploration and using exploration in their lives. I do motivational speeches for businesses and talk about how my cave diving experiences and things that I've learned might, you know, give them lessons in their own businesses. So there's a lot of messages that I give in the inspirational sense. In terms of causes, I'm you know, a voice of a water advocate and a climate change activist, I guess you could call me. Yeah. Just trying to, you know, spread the information so that people, like, if they listen to my expeditions and my stories, they're going to be filled with wonder. And when they're listening to these wonderful stories, I could shove a little bit of truth in and say, I've seen climate change in the Arctic, you know, or I've seen, you know, changes in our water systems in Florida or the Bahamas, and here's what I've learned from that. And people listen because they're enthralled with the stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way to throw that in there and make it important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, otherwise it'd be so damn depressing. Really. I mean, some of the environmental issues that we're facing these days are dire, and it's easy to get swept up in the, what can I do? You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what kind of stuff is big issues right now?
Well, absolutely water. I mean, we have tons of water on the planet, but we're running out of clean, fresh water resources that are safe to drink, and inexpensive resources that are safe enough to drink. Mm-hmm. So water quality is an incredibly important issue because, you know, you can imagine if we don't guarantee everybody across the planet to have a safe drinking water source and basic sanitation, then they'll do almost anything in order to get clean water to nourish their children and feed their crops and survive. I mean, wouldn't you or I, if the taps were suddenly turned off in the house, or in the neighborhood or in the city, go out and do anything we needed to do to quench the thirst. Mm-hmm. So we have to realize that if we don't solve these problems globally, then we're going to live in a world of conflict and war and uncertainty. So water is really, really important. Climate change also is incredibly important because we only have a few years to make some brave changes that are going to affect our ability to survive on this planet.
Yeah.
The planet is going to be fine, but still whether human race will rise to the occasion, you know.
Totally. Yeah. So what are some
of the... scarier for you.
Yeah, true.
Than me. I'm older.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, what are some of the brave changes that we need to do?
Well, I mean, to begin with, we need to immediately, you know, lose the love affair with the petroleum-based energy. You know, I'm not saying turn it off today because we can't. You know, we've got to transition to solar and wind and other things. Mm-hmm. We still need some of that petroleum-based, you know, power on hand until we figure out how to balance the grid, you know, or do everything on a small scale with solar and wind and storage, batteries. So we've got to figure out all of those technologies fast. Mm-hmm. We've got to figure out what to do about the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and in the oceans and find a way to quickly, you know, sequester and remove. I mean, things are going to continue to get worse for a long time. We've heated up the oceans and they're only, you know, beginning to, you know, rear their ugly head with shifting ocean currents, you know, species on the move, species extinction, bigger storms. And so we've got to figure out how to deal with this warming planet quick and deal with the CO2. Yeah.
Man, it's crazy. Yeah. It seems like so big and it's like, just seems like it's snowballing almost, but our things,
it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we don't have the luxury to quit.
You know, right.
We can't be pessimists. We've got to do exactly what I have to do in that cave. I don't know the big picture about how I'm going to get home at the end of the day when I'm stuck behind a scientist who's panicking and my life support is spewing the gas out of my tank and the line's broken and I'm in complete darkness. You know, I could give up and die. Right? That'd be easy. But I got to keep working one small step at a time. Okay, first thing I got to do, I can't breathe water, so I got to do something about my life support. Okay, I can't like find my way out of here unless I, you know, manage the navigation and get moving. Now I got to deal with the panicking scientists. I got to move towards the light. I got to move one step at a time. And right now, we don't know how we're going to solve the planetary, you know, global climate change, but we do know the small next best steps. Mm-hmm. We do know how to, you know, reduce our, you know, use of all of this disposable plastic shit. You know, we do know how to start moving towards cleaner energy resources. We do know how to vote with our wallets, even if our politics are completely out of control. Mm-hmm. We do know how to vote with our wallets and support the industries and the businesses and the kind of world that we want to live in. And if we do that and start, you know, small steps, thinking bigger and bigger, keep working towards the light, then we'll do it. Like, I step into the darkness every day, and that terrifies most people. They can think of nothing but claustrophobia and fear in that darkness. Mm-hmm. But I would say that everyone on the planet has to learn to start stepping towards what scares them, move into the darkness, and trust me that your eyes will adjust to the light. And in that adjustment, you will find an opportunity to do something completely new for yourself and maybe completely new and remarkable for humankind.
Yeah. Wow. Cool. So do you think it's just kind of like what we should do is just everybody as an individual should start, you know, doing the, I don't know. I mean, what can I do, yeah. I guess? What would you say?
Yeah, we all have easy steps forward. So there's funny campaigns like, you know, stop using straws. It's, you know, useless plastic in the environment. Yeah, that's something that's a useful, but it's figurative. It's a little too small to make an enormous impact on the planet. But, right. you know, you could carry a spork around and start using your own washable spork. You could start using a refillable water bottle. And like I said, vote with your wallet. You know, buy for life, you know, stop the kind of useless consumerism that my generation spawned and left you guys to clean up after. So make small changes in your life. If you're not a vegetarian now, be a part-time vegetarian, because a burger probably tons of water to bring to you, right? But just eating something, you know, that grows from the ground is a whole lot more environmentally responsible. So make small choices in your life, and then support the politicians at the, you know, first at the municipal level, locally, that are going to make good zoning board decisions for you. And then, you know, at the state level, support the kind of people that create the kind of world that you want to live in, and take over. Don't stand for this crap that we're being fed from politics today. Like own the kind of world that you want to live in, and know that those small decisions will make a better future for you.
Yeah. Cool. That's
and
good.
And vote. Vote.
Yes, totally. Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, because I don't know, I'm sure a lot of people feel this too, where it's like, man, should I just use this plastic fork and then throw it? Is it really going to make that big a difference? But it does, yeah. Like that kind of stuff really does matter. So I feel like it's kind of tough to see the bigger picture with just these small little things that you make, or these small decisions that you make and do, but it totally does matter, huh?
It also changes the mindset of you and everyone around you. It makes you think every time that you consume, you know. And when other people see you do it, they jump on the bandwagon too, and they feel better about it. And those small changes lead to bigger things and bigger things. And you know, we gotta do it. Yeah. Like I said, you know, you could just curl up in a fetal position and close your eyes and die. But if you want to create a world worth living in, then you got to start small and work bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, like I've seen, like, you know, in my friend group and stuff, everyone uses like reusable water bottles and stuff now. Yep. And like, you know, everybody recycles, and there's a lot of that going on. I could see, you know,
Great. There's
total big changes in that kind of stuff, which is good.
Yeah, it's great. I see a bicycle behind you. So.
Yes, I got my bike too.
Yeah, two-wheel smile machine, right?
Two-wheel smile machine.
If you use that a few more times than a car, then that's making a huge carbon impact. Yeah,
totally. Man, well, this is cool. I love talking to you. It's so fun to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So I guess, and then you mentioned also just kind of clean water too, right? How, like, is there anything... I don't know. Can you just talk about that, I guess?
Yeah. I mean, clean water is you know, so important to you know, our health and our future, but also to the future of a stable, conflict-free planet. People ask me, well, what kind of water do you drink? And I'm a real proponent of tap water, and I'll often get a response from people, yeah, but what about tap water, like Flint, Michigan, you know, people are drinking lead and they didn't even know it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, sure, there are dirty municipal water resources, but there are ways for everybody to check and see what the quality of their municipal water resource is like. So there's the Environmental Working Group in the U.S. monitors water resources all around the country, and you can type in your city, and it'll say, your water comes from here, and here's the chemical components of what you're drinking. And you know what? There's too much chromium in this water, chromium 6, like that dry cleaning type fluid that Erin Brockovich brought attention to with her work. Right. Or there's too much lead. You know, they'll give you a breakdown, and then they'll say, but you could keep using this water resource, but we recommend go out and buy this, or this filter. And that'll make it cleaner and safer for you, because there can be things in clear water that aren't safe for you. I mean, it might be clear and it might taste good, but it may not be safe. Like, you might not be able to taste it. Mm-hmm. Now, bottled water is not better, because bottled water I can't remember the percentage, but a very large percentage of bottled water in the U.S. is tap water. It's been bottled from the very same municipal water source and just run through an extra filter and thrown into a plastic bottle of dubious quality.
Yeah.
Might be leaching like endocrine disrupting chemicals into your system. So, you know, your glass of water from the tap or into the stainless steel bottle, it's probably a lot safer than most of the bottled water that you'd be able to buy.
Yeah, that's good. I feel
and
like that's
bottled water is freaking expensive.
Yeah, it is. Totally. I feel like that's such a huge misconception people have about bottled water.
Yeah.
You know, totally. Cool. Well, that's good. I'm glad I'm on the right track. Then I got my filter and all that stuff. So, what was you said there was a website I could go to that would have all that?
I wish I knew what the URL was, but it's the Environmental Working Group in the U.S.
Yeah. Environmental Working Group.
It's actually a non-governmental organization. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh.
Cool.
EWG. Yeah.
EWG. Perfect. I'm gonna check that out.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, this is great. I mean, and just I don't know. We'll kind of wrap it up here, I guess. But I was curious if you have like a kind of a highlight of your career and your cave diving and stuff so far that you really enjoyed that you wanted to share.
Oh, wow. You know, I've had the opportunity to go to so many amazing places around the world, you know, but one thing that really continues to fascinate me about underwater caves are the animals that swim inside the caves. So there are animals inside underwater caves that live their entire life cycle in the complete darkness of the underwater cave. So they never come out. They've never seen the sun. They don't have any eyes because they don't need any eyes, right? They're living in darkness. They don't have any color. So they're albino, they're white. Because what's the point of color if nobody else can see you?
Right.
But they do have really unique sensory organs, and they have very unique, chemoreceptors, and they can teach us a lot of really interesting stuff about evolution and survival, because some of these animals predate the extinction of the dinosaurs. So we have animals swimming in the caves today that are identical to the fossil record from over 65 million years ago. So a fossil from 65 million years ago is identical in the same form today swimming in the cave.
Whoa.
So that's crazy, you know? And then some of these animals inside the cave also have unbelievable, like, you know, chemical compounds in their bodies. So they have antimicrobial characteristics, anti-cancer agents that are like 100 or 200 times the potency of some of the similar stuff that we might find outside the cave. So the caves are not just an area for exploration of the space inside the planet and exploration of the water resources, but also exploration of life. I mean, we look for water on other planets when we look for life, but if we look inside our planet, we will find that life is ubiquitous, and some of that life can teach us some incredible lessons.
Man, that is cool. That's crazy stuff that's still in there, and we don't even really... It's hard for us to access these animals and stuff, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I have such a cool job.
Yeah, you really do.
I can go do this and work and collaborate with scientists on really interesting investigations.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I'm so glad that, you know, you and scientists and people like you are doing this kind of stuff. You know, it's so interesting to learn about, but it's also super important too.
Yeah, thanks.
Totally. Cool. Well, thanks so much for talking, Jill. I mean, where can people like find you on the internet or find more stuff about
you? Yeah. Head over to my website, which is intotheplanet.com. And you can find links to my, you know, Facebook and YouTube and everything else there. And pretty soon in the summer of 2019, I'll have a book coming out called Into the Planet. And that's going to be published by HarperCollins in the U.S. and Penguin Random House in Canada. And it'll be a big international release next August.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Congrats.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Thanks.
Awesome. Well, cool. Well, thanks again, Jill. Appreciate you being on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Hey, guys. Travis is here again. So the podcast is over. It's done. So you can just leave right now. So don't worry about it. But I just had a couple things I wanted to mention and say to you guys. So first of all, thanks for listening to the episode or watching the episode. Super appreciate that. If you want to connect with me or in the podcast, we have a website. It's called curiosityness.com. Curiosityness is CuriosityNess. Kind of weird. But that's what it is. Curiosityness.com. You can go there. We have an Instagram. Instagram.com/curiosityness podcast. So not just curiosityness for the username. I'm on Instagram as Trav DeRose, TravDeRose, if you want to find just me. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/curiosityness. We're on YouTube. I think just go to YouTube and search curiosityness and we'll pop up. I don't think we have a URL for that one. Sorry. Oh, and we have I have an email address, travis@curiosityness.com. So if you want to email me, you know, give me your thoughts on the show, suggestions, tips, maybe like a suggestion for a guest who could come on, maybe yourself or somebody that you know who might be interested or you would like to hear on the podcast, let me know about that stuff. I would love to hear that. And then if you could leave a review too for the podcast, that'd be super appreciated. The reviews in Apple Podcast or Spotify or whatever, wherever you're listening to this, super help. Just drop like a star, whatever star review. I won't tell you to do 5, but it'd be nice. So drop a review. You can write a review even too if you want. That would be even better. But that's about it. So thanks again for watching. I super appreciate you, you know, listening to the whole show and staying here. Thanks again. Have a good day. Bye-bye.